Today on the program, three thinkers with three perspectives on food, our urban environment and future tastes. All three of our guests were in Australia recently for a week-long series of design workshops, public talks and events held at The Edge in Brisbane. The event was called Unlimited, Designing for the Asia Pacific, and that's where I caught up with them. Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and welcome to the program. So, who have we got? Well, our thinkers are London-based architect CJ Lim, Jeb Brugman, author of Welcome to the Urban Revolution, How Cities Are Changing the World, and Paul Bennett, Chief Creative Officer of the design and innovation company IDEO. Let's hear first from CJ Lim. He's the founder of Studio 8 Architects in London. A great deal of his focus in recent years has been on helping to redesign the city environment to accommodate urban agriculture. CJ Lim talks about the idea of a smart city, and what he means by that is a place where agriculture and urbanisation interconnect, working to make a more sustainable living environment. In fact, Smart Cities is the name of a book he's recently co-written, in which he details the urban farming concepts that he and his team have put together for the new town of Guangming in southern China. CJ Lim.
Smart City is a vision, a provocation, a manifesto for better living in the 21st century. Intelligent living, not necessarily high-tech living, but living in a sustainable way.
And in that sense, tied in very much with that is the idea of urban farming, isn't it?
Yes.
People in urban areas, because we know the world is getting much more urbanised, and that's been going on for hundreds of years, but getting them much more in touch with food, with the food that they consume.
Yeah, I mean, smart cities is very much about the symbiosis of nature and man-made built forms, about understanding where our food comes from, looking at food security, but taking these issues into an urban planning policy, looking at the possibility how the design of future architecture and cities would be influenced by our food security.
Many people, including many of our legislators and our planners, would actually see agriculture almost as the antithesis of the urban environment. Why do you think it's got to that stage? Why have we taken on that kind of view?
I think it's because farming has always been seen as secondary, and food over the years has become increasingly cheap because of mass production. And I think that's really a very scary attitude, because food production, global food production, is falling. And you in Australia, you're in the land of plenty. You probably don't think about food security as much as in some other countries. But I think it is really vital that these questions start to be implemented or questioned or introduced in how you build your city, how we should all live in certain countries.
Global production of food might be falling, but the globalisation of food, in a sense, is on the increase, isn't it? I mean, you go to a Woolworths in Australia here, you'll find fish from Tanzania. There with the fish and prawns from Australia or New Zealand, say. Is that the same across the world?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I have not visited all supermarkets all around the world, but, for example, you take supermarkets in the UK, 90% of our food comes from outside the UK. I mean, our vegetables especially, green beans, lettuce, tomatoes, they come from sort of as far as Africa and Kenya and Morocco and so forth. And I think that is quite scary. And you in Australia apparently are one of the largest importer of salmon from Scotland. Could you imagine how ridiculous this is to import fish from right across the other side of the world? And I think, you know, we need to be very careful about our carbon footprint. This sounds like doomsday here. I don't want to make it into that. But the thing is that we could actually eat well and still be very conscious about the food miles on our table. On the other hand, you know, if we were to promote urban agriculture, a lot of these problems would not just, they wouldn't be a problem. They would actually become innovative elements within our everyday living, our planning, and our design of the future lifestyle.
Now, tell us about urban agriculture. And in the work that you've done in China, you've actually established farms back inside the city centre.
Yep.
You've put them back in there. Just tell us about that, the process of doing that.
I think we have always, I mean, we in the most general sense, designers and planners and thinkers and politicians have always thought, when you create housing community, there's housing community. When there's farm, there's farm. There's two separates and the two never meet. And in our case, we have combined, we hybridized the two together, farming and housing together. And what was also really important in China, for example, is to actually have a mixed-use community, mixed group, mixed income community, where you have farmers living with white-collar workers. In China currently, new communities are only for single salary economic strata. The poor do not mix with the rich. And here, this is an opportunity where one could actually serve the other and vice versa. And I think that's really important. And in our case, the design was very much based on the layering, in a way, the vertical stacking of farming and housing. So one on top of the other one. And then you sort of have this kind of almost pyramidal thing, and the top would be a reservoir where you collect water, rainwater, and the rainwater would release right across the terracing to irrigate the farms.
Now, we covered vertical farming on the program last year, so that's an important element in what you're trying to do in the urban environment.
Yeah, we feel that, you know, urban planning should be compact. It should be stacked. We should look at it in a kind of vertical way rather than horizontal, because horizontal planning encourages usage of car, sprawl of cities, and sprawl of community. You get Los Angeles, which is one of the most sort of unsustainable, carbon-burning city in the world.
So where are you at in terms of these ideas of urban farming? You know, are we at the implementation stage with major cities yet?
We're hoping that it would be implemented, but the policies that we establish in Guangming are being introduced right across the different regions in South China now. They are hoping that, you know, that new developments would not be old type where you just have housing and then food has to come from long, long way. And communities, farming communities, are also being preserved and encouraged and empowered. And that's something that we have been in constant conversation with the Chinese government. Empowerment of farming communities is completely a new concept to them because they are the lowest of the rankings. They are just seen to be the labor to produce food, not realizing that they are the people that will save China from sort of burning a bigger hole in the sky. And I think these policies are being implemented, but slowly. As I said, the projects we've been working on are absolutely massive. We're talking, you know, 10, 12 kilometers square large. And because these projects are private-public initiatives, it's taking time, but it's the policies are being put in place.
And you are confident that they will actually be built? They will come to fruition?
I'm confident that they will come to fruition in some form, but maybe not the ambition that we envisage in the first place. But yes, the policies will definitely be put in.
So at least starting small and
Absolutely.
Then building from there.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier a city like Los Angeles, a vast, sprawling metropolis, which is well established. What's the hope of a city like that, or even a city like London? What's the hope of it actually changing its ways and being able to effectively incorporate some of these ideas of urban farming?
I think it's much more likely that this culture of urban farming, sustainable eating, sustainable cities to be established in China more than the other cities that like Los Angeles or even London. I think the Chinese has the ambition to really be ahead of the game. They are very conscious. The middle class group of well-educated Chinese that is rapidly growing, and they are very, very conscious about green issues, environmental issues, and health issues, and nutritional issues. And that really helps. I think having an informed audience within a country really could support these, that could support these issues, would really help the government to implement a lot of these things. Whereas, you know, in the West, generally we are a bit sort of callous about the way that cities are planned. We take for granted that we are in the land of plenty. You know, if we don't grow it, we can buy it from somewhere else. And I think that is really, really sad. And I think, you know, with the Chinese, I think they are slowly coming round to the idea also that, you know, money is important, but wealth could come in other different forms like good nutrition, good health, good education. And the Chinese, more than anybody else, they love their food, as you know. So I think this is all going to happen quite rapidly.
Professor CJ Lim, food for thought, pardon the pun. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
And CJ Lim is the founder of Studio 8 Architects in the UK, as well as being Professor of Architecture and Cultural Design at University College London. This is Future Tense on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web. new ideas, new approaches, new technologies. Today, we hear three perspectives on urbanisation, urban farming and food security.
Interestingly, what happens when people move to cities in pursuit of higher income, one of the first things they allocate that higher income to is to more protein in their diet. So if you look at China between 1981 and 2004, in terms of the consumption of a rural Chinese person and an urban Chinese person in 2004, they've increased their consumption of seafood 74%. And their consumption of meat by more than 40% as they've become urban dwellers. So the question is, where does all this protein come from when scientists are telling us that within 40 years' time, most of the fish stocks in the world will be depleted at the rate that we're consuming it now?
And that search for protein, Jeb Brugman argues, will define our urban future. As I mentioned earlier, Mr. Brugman is the author of Welcome to the Urban Revolution: How Cities Are Changing the World. He's also managing partner of the innovation and strategy consultancy, The Next Practice.
What it's really about is how we make our cities the places where we produce our nutrients and where we recycle our nutrients, not any differently than any other ecosystem. So in order to get through the ecological crisis that we're facing, whether it's related to climate or the fisheries or soil depletion or the shortages of fresh water, we have to make our cities ecosystems that produce, not extract from nature, but produce the things that the people who live within them need, including their protein.
And that idea of recycling, I mean, that's going to be important because literally of space dimensions within a city, because I know you're not an advocate of sprawling cities. You're an advocate of urbanization in a compact way, aren't you?
I promote compactness for primary reason that it's the only economical way to optimize the investment we make in our cities, right? So when we put things close together, let's take a public transit system. To have a public transit system run through a low-density area, you invest in all of the buses, the lines, if it's light rail, the lines, to run a few lines to serve the spread-out population. When you create compactness along the transit line, you can run multiple lines more frequently, and therefore you get more value for your investment. So ultimately, I argue that urban nations, to be fiscally sound, need to deal with the issue of density as an economic concept. Now, there are all kinds of densities that can be created. People just think there's, you know, one kind of high-rise. We can create all kinds of densities. But I'm going further with this argument about food. What we need to do in order to produce food for 9 billion people, given the ecological stresses that the planet is under, is we need to produce the surface area. We have to multiply the surface area on the planet available for food production. And there's only one way to do that, which is to build vertically.
So in that sense, we're talking about using rooftops, using the tops of car parks, using re-examining those areas as potential areas for supplying our cities with food.
Yes, verticality is one of the underlying natural resources that comes with building a city. To create an environment, like say coral mollusks create an environment, or like trees create a forest ecosystem, in two dimensions, is really not tapping into the potential. When we build cities, what we do is create more land area upon which to live by building up or upon which to grow our food. And the vertical farms is more than just using the rooftops, but as you likely know, it's really about creating production systems within a building where the protein production, the fish, the waste of the fish is used to fertilize the crop. So you create a whole nutrient cycle within the building that in a way is kind of a micro ecosystem in its own right.
And isn't that type of system, isn't that going to determine what sort of products we can grow? If you're looking at a vertical farm to make it work economically within a community, within a city, you're going to have to make some decisions about what's going to be planted and what's not going to be planted, what's going to be grown and what's not going to be grown, aren't you?
Yeah, and this is a whole new territory in terms of the experimentation of understanding what species function together within a system. We're doing nothing any different than what in nature, in a way, was kind of the trial and error, the laws of survival about, you know, how you can create a synergy between species, right, so they can coexist together and be managed together. But the key thing is, on the demand side, we can also deal with the problem. In other words, I think that we'll end up having to have regional cuisines that are based on what can be grown within the urban region. And you start to see this a little bit now, you know, the rise of specific local cuisines that people take pride in. Now what we have to do is connect up the supply that we can grow within a region with the taste of the regional cuisine. And it's happening. I talk and am writing about, for instance, the region of Metro Vancouver that has a massive agricultural system. People in Vancouver spend about $5 billion a year on food. Of course, a lot of that comes in from outside. It's processed food. But it produces $10 billion worth of agricultural products a year within the metro area. The metro area agricultural lands count for about 1.5% of the whole province of British Columbia's agricultural lands, but they produce 28% of the food production within the province of British Columbia. So what we see here is a metro area that is evolving and now has a regional food strategy, has a huge industry, employs 1 out of 8 people within the metro area, within the city, in food production, which can increasingly be targeted to the consumers of the city itself.
In many cities, though, when you walk into a supermarket, you start looking at where those products have come from, the fresh food as well as the canned food, the processed food. You'll find that a lot of them are international. They've come from other parts of the globe. That's increased over the last couple of decades. Is that likely to start decreasing? Are we likely to start seeing it go the other way?
Well, you know, I think that all depends on the success of these regional food strategies. What we ought to do is compete with that model. I don't think it's worth taking an ideological position about whether supermarkets and their food chains should be allowed or are good in some kind of moralistic sense. But I think what we can do is develop within our regional agricultural systems a better quality offering at a better price. And so what we see in the cities like Havana and Shenzhen and Vancouver, as they invest in regional food systems, they're also investing in the cold storage systems. They're creating markets where people, the farmers, oftentimes small farmers who can't sell to the big chains, can sell directly to the consumer in these markets. And it's not just the quaint little Saturday morning farmer's market, but, you know, massive market operations that provide a different type of food of a different quality directly to the people.
But it's that idea of price of economics that's going to be important, isn't it? Not just for the consumer, but for those big retailers, for those big producers. Do you see a situation where, you know, we know that energy costs are going to increase, that fuel costs are going to increase over time. If what you're saying about localized production is correct, do you see a time where that localized food actually becomes cheaper for those big industrial conglomerates than shipping in or flying food from all around the world?
It's quite possible because of the extent to which the industrial food system, the globalized industrial food system, is dependent on this bounty of nature that it extracts from. So just the cost of good soil is going to go up as we deplete our soils around the world. The cost of water to irrigate is going to drive up the cost of food within this modern industrial food system. So as the natural resource pressures push up prices in that system, what we hope we can do is by creating a regional resource system is to begin to compete on price. Right now, what's happening, of course, is we're competing on quality and on a cultural experience as well. We're building a culture of appreciation for regional things.
How much work, though, how much real work is going into thinking about these ideas, into design and into actual implementation in various parts of the world?
Well, interestingly, when I look at the regional food strategies that have come up, most of them in the Western world have looked at how land can be made available at the ground level. And there's, in the United States in particular, there's been permitting for some of these high-rise farms as business propositions. So in terms of land use regulation, that's where the innovation has taken place. Interestingly, though, in Shenzhen, China, they're making $1.3 billion Australian investment in the infrastructure and in the technology and in farm support to build up the system. So it's a massive investment undertaking to ensure that they can meet their target of 60% of the protein, vegetables, and fruits consumed by people in Shenzhen will be produced within the regional agricultural system.
Jeb Brugman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, our final guest is Paul Bennett, Chief Creative Officer of the international design company IDEO. Mr. Bennett ran a 2-day Food Futures workshop as part of the Unlimited event in Brisbane. Like Jeb Brugman and CJ Lim, he sees a future in which economic and environmental factors will force a rethinking of the divide between the places where we grow our food and the places where we consume it. But he cautions against assuming that the recent explosion in food-related media means we have a better understanding of food and the way it's produced. So here's Paul Bennett.
The dial goes both ways. I think on one hand, we're absolutely saturated with sort of sensationalist media about food. So we've got Food Inc. and Michael Moore and, you know, Super Size Me. We've got a sort of media, a maelstrom of media in terms of food and sort of sensationalism. And yet on the other hand, people sort of blindly consume stuff in a supermarket and sort of assume a chicken comes from somewhere, but they don't know that it comes from an animal, you know. So we've got this sort of, on one hand, oversaturation. On the other hand, we've got this sort of ignorance. So how do we help people understand? How do we help people navigate? We don't want to just lambast people for their lack of knowledge. We want to help them learn. And we want, I think a word that's come up over and over again is this idea of educate people.
So how do you go about doing that, though? I mean, how do you get people to understand a bit more about the structures that exist around the things that they consume?
I mean, one of the ideas is to localize it as much as possible. I mean, one of the things that I've kept on hearing in the last few days is local things that are going on, local growing experiments, local gardens, community efforts, people coming together around certain things. So I think as much as possible, I think tangibilizing the discussion for people so that they can see what it means to them, getting them involved in it. A word I keep using is participatory. Want people to participate as much as possible in the consumption of food. In the growing and the production of food as much as its consumption. So again, getting people involved in the whole discussion in the end-to-end rather than just being a sort of mindless consumer of it, but being a participant in the whole chain.
Do you think, though, that people want to be involved in that kind of way? I mean, people who turn up to these sort of workshops would, but average people out there?
That's a great question. I mean, the last thing any of us want to do is just have a discussion with a bunch of creative intelligentsia and suddenly we all go back to our day jobs. That's not the point. I actually think we're starting to see evidence globally that people really are more interested and more concerned about where the food comes from. And, you know, I think we are looking to try and understand the sort of micro experiments that are going on out there in all parts of the world. And I mean, the real world, not just the urban kind of rarefied world, that we can highlight and talk about. And again, I've had hundreds of examples have been brought forward in the last few days from things that are going on locally that are really interesting, things that are going on in both indigenous and non-indigenous communities that I actually think we can start to tell those stories. So yes, I do think that there's examples out there.
Well, tell us about some of those examples, particularly where your company's concerned.
We are working with Jamie Oliver, the chef, obviously, in helping him bring his TED Prize alive. So the Jamie Oliver Food Revolution is something we've been working on. And trying to understand, you know, how to ground efforts into schools, into communities with people that are trying to sort of grow their own food. So again, you know, this sounds very lame to say this, but I'll say it. This is not about big ideas. This is about little ideas. I gave a talk last night and I said, small times many equals big. And to me, the idea of little ideas that are going on in people's, you know, it could be as simple as somebody growing their own tomatoes. But, you know, every little bit counts and trying to sort of join all those little stories together is what we're doing.
When it comes to food consumption and supply, I mean, we often think about it as an environmental issue, as a political issue. We don't often, though, think of it as a design issue, do we?
No, but I think we should. I mean, I think, again, design is a loaded word, and I'm going to qualify what I mean by design. We're certainly not talking about decorating and making pretty. We're not talking about design's role just to sort of decorate the or sort of create a sort of artificial functionality here. We're talking about people really designing a collective future together. So, again, this is about sort of creating a movement around awareness and education and helping people understand what this means to them and getting them to feel like they have the ability to design these things themselves.
What about big corporations, though? I mean, you've worked with a lot of big corporations. Where do they fit into this?
Well, big corporations are on some level interesting and scary at the same time. Scary because, of course, they're perceived by many people to be manufacturers who don't really care about the human process. They just care about profit. My experience with a lot of large corporations is they actually don't feel like that. They just don't know how to do anything about feeling like that, that they actually are people inside these organizations that are passionate and want to do something to make change happen. So I think that the opportunity is to help use the scale of the big operators, but to actually create things that impact people on a local level, so actually they can be very beneficial in this process.
And so in that sense, would you be talking about partnerships? I mean, yes. So partnerships with local communities, with big food producers?
Yeah, I mean, I think partnership is a really good word. I think coalition is a really good word. I think enablement is a really good word. Those are all of the things that we're talking about here, getting big corporations to partner with small communities, to actually create different economic models that support communities in different ways, to actually work together to create something. And I think, again, the piece that has to match all of this is consumers have to start to understand that their consumption has to be different, that you're not going to get food all year round, for example, that you're going to have to embrace seasonality. And that's one of the ideas we've been talking about a lot about this workshop, that is it okay to get food all year round when it's actually artificially constructed and, you know, the carbon footprint of something that's had to be imported is incredibly prohibitive. So the behavior that needs to change on the other side of all of that is something else that we've been addressing here.
And in terms of that seasonality, I mean, that means making that idea of seasonal food much more attractive, doesn't it? It means working on that as a product in itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, a guy at the workshop told a really great story that I'd love to share with you. He said that he'd gone to Italy with his wife, who's Italian, and he said that at the end of the summer, all the people in the town that he was staying in got together and they all went to the tomato harvest together. And he said they all picked tomatoes. They spent the whole day doing it. He said it was real fun. Everybody got sort of drunk and hung out and picked tomatoes. And at the end of the day, they all cooked together and made tomato sauce. And he said, and then they all took it away to their own homes and they had a sort of batch of it each. And he said, what the hell happened to the rest of us that we've just totally disconnected ourselves from the whole process of gathering, preparing, and the celebration of food? The idea of being connected to what it is that we eat rather than just opening a tin, I think is quite an interesting idea.
And just a final question. We talked to Jeb Brugman about the increasing pressures of urbanisation on our society and what that means for food. What's your perspective on that?
I don't think urbanisation means that we're all going to suddenly be living in sort of tin cans, though. I mean, I think, you know, I'm starting to see evidence, and I mean, I think Jeb would talk about it as well, of really interesting things going on at an urban level that I find very regenerative. So urban gardens, urban farming, urban beekeeping, huge trend at the moment in urban bees. So just this whole idea that you live in a city doesn't mean that you can be disconnected from nature. In fact, I think in many ways we're starting to sort of reclaim nature in the city.
More than just a niche or middle class, if you like, endeavour.
This is absolutely not. I think we're at the edge. I think we're on the cusp of something quite powerful where people are starting to understand at every economic level that they need to get some control back over the things that they're surrounding themselves with. And I think the food and the things that they consume is one of those places. So whether you're growing herbs on a window box or you're beekeeping or whatever it is, I think people are trying desperately to connect themselves or even just understanding. Again, it doesn't have to be about doing it at that level. Just understanding or questioning where things come from and making choices around that, making smart choices, is something that is going on everywhere.
And suddenly, we're all feeling peckish. Paul Bennett, our final thinker on food and urbanisation.